So welcome back to the Power of the Herd Web Symposium, and today we're going to be looking at Guiding Principle 8, which is employ non-predatory power liberally and predatory power sparingly. And I'd like to welcome back Linda Kahanoff.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, so where do we start here? We touched on this sort of before in the previous chapter very slightly, and you start explaining about this video that you saw, which was about an altercation between lions and buffalo, and how it developed, and you know how surprisingly it developed. So, for those who haven't seen the video or indeed read the Guiding Principle yet, maybe you'd just like to do a quick recap of how that story unfolded.
Yes, and you can, as far as I know, you can still look this video up on YouTube and watch it yourself. It's quite amazing. It's called Battle at Kruger, and it shows an altercation between a rather large pride of lion. I think there's at least a half a dozen lions, and also a herd of water buffalo in Africa. And it's just, you know, an amateur African safari video, and you can hear the tourists talking in the background. And there's this huge watering hole or pond or lake, depending on, it's hard to tell how big it is. And they're just looking at this family of water buffalo walking down probably toward the watering hole to get a drink. And they see a bull and a cow and their calf walking together completely alone. And then you hear all the tourists going, oh, because they look over and see that there are some lions hiding in the grass about 100 yards away. And at a certain moment, the bull senses the lions and turns to run and herd his family away. And of course, now the lions leap out of the grass and they run specifically toward the calf. They know exactly who the most vulnerable member of that family is, and they always seek out the most vulnerable, easiest kill is what they do. That's their job. And so they grab a hold of this calf, and they do it with such force that these lions and this baby calf plunge down this little hill into the lake. And then you see, it's like a bad day for everyone, I have to say, because these lions are trying to pull this baby calf out of the lake, and then a crocodile comes up and starts attacking them to try to pull this calf away. And so finally the lions work together and they pull this calf up on shore. And the calf is laying there, and you're thinking, this guy must already be dead. There's just no way this calf is still alive. And you can see them getting ready to take that final fatal bite. And all of a sudden, the parents of these buffalo return with a herd of what must be close to 50 buffalo. And I have no idea, because it was 4 minutes between the time the calf was taken down and when the parents returned. So it's really astonishing to think, how did they go back and find these buffalo, and how did they communicate to the buffalo to come and help them out? I mean, it would normally take parents of a child who had been attacked longer than that to go get help. So right. It was very impressive. So these 50 buffalo surround these lions, and they're engaging in heroic, altruistic behavior. I mean, they are literally all there to rescue this one calf, and they're taking significant personal risks to do it. And you can see them all trying to see what are the optimal angles for getting these lions to move away. And one bull finally leaps forward and grabs one of the lions up in his horns and tosses that lion 6 feet in the air. And at that moment, all the other buffalo gain leverage, and the lions are, of course, very nervous at this point. And finally, you see the lions, they scatter in all directions. And then you see the calf stand up, and the herd surrounds the calf and welcomes the calf back into the herd. And so we don't know whether this calf is now going to suffer because he was, in fact, mortally wounded, or whether he wasn't that hurt. We just don't know. Nobody tells us what the end of that story was. But what we do know is that the buffalo took significant risks of their own while also gathering the power of an entire herd to rescue a single herd member.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, when you compare, you know, if a child was in danger in the park and the parents sort of ran off to collect other parents, how long would it take to explain what was going on and what they needed to do? And I mean, obviously, we don't know about how animals communicate very well. We don't know very well about how they communicate, but it's just incredible that they could, obviously they were in the vicinity, but all the same, just to round them up and pull them over. I mean, What is your hunch as to how that was done?
Well, I know from my own interactions with spending time with herds of horses, and this is something I talked about, I guess, way back in Guiding Principle 2, when the horses, when there's something alarming that happens, it's as if your nervous system, by tensing up, sends an alarm out that then is contagious to everyone else's body in the vicinity. Almost like it sends a vibration out that's silent, so it hits your gut, causes your gut to clench, and then causes you to look in the direction where the signal was coming from. So I've actually had that experience of a nonverbal feeling of fear being transferred to me over a considerable distance by horses, and seeing the entire herd coordinate in emergency behavior simultaneously as my own body was poised to do the same thing. So there's some ability of a mammal's nervous system to shoot out an alarm of fear that then affects everybody else at the level of the body before the brain can even catch up to what's going on. So I know that that's part of what was going on. What I don't understand is how these buffalo were able to send that alarm to a herd of buffalo that nobody had any idea was close by, to rally them and get them to come back and also take significant personal risks to save that calf. I have no idea how that happened. I don't even know how you do that with humans necessarily.
Yeah, and I guess for those who are involved with horses, they know, especially if they've read your books, they're kind of aware of the way that horses do communicate. But it seems like they're not alone, and obviously they're not, because we talk about us being able to communicate in the same way through this, through our guts. But obviously cows and water buffalo can do it too.
Yes, yes, and they are not the frightened weaklings that everybody makes them out to be. I mean, for a long time we've heard philosophers and scientists talk about how, you know, prey animals are just quivering victims living at the mercy of these powerful carnivores. And in this chapter, or this guiding principle and other chapters, what we see is a lot of evidence in nature for the fact that that's not even vaguely true, that mature large herbivores are very powerful, they're extremely dangerous, and that the lions don't really attack adult herbivores. They may try if they're really desperate in a group, but if a group of carnivores attacks a group of herbivores, it's a pretty even fight, and quite often the carnivores walk away hungry and injured, if not mortally wounded. So it's very exciting for those of us who have lived our lives wanting to, who've been resistant to the idea of being predatory and carnivorous with other members of our own species, those of us who would like to find a different way of power, to see that in nature this kind of power already exists. It's the power of the herd. It's the power of a mature, non-predatory animal to defend those members of the herd that are most vulnerable.
And have you witnessed that? Well, you probably haven't been in the situation with horses, but have you witnessed that with horses too, or... I've heard
similar
stories.
Yes, actually, it was these early instances with my own horses that made me start to look up more information with other non-predatory species to come up with the idea of non-predatory power. Because, for instance, when I lived at Apache Springs Ranch, it was right on the edge of this huge nature preserve. And we had mountain lions and bears and coyotes and... first of all, the horses were maybe a little nervous when a mountain lion or bear was in the area, but they didn't run off like maniacs. They just got close to each other and then just watched what was going on. So you could see they all came together, and then they were just watching from a safe distance as to the behavior of the carnivore. And so they didn't just run screaming in the other direction in a blind panic. Their first impulse was to come together, which you know always also that now they're ready to protect themselves. And in terms of coyotes and large dogs, the horses already knew they had the advantage, you know. So it's not like they saw a predator and they automatically freaked out. you know, my mare Rasa would chase coyotes out of her pasture, and it looked like she was having fun with them. It was almost like bowling for coyotes for her. It was like a pastime. The coyotes didn't look like they were having fun, but she did. And then my stallion Merlin, we had some aggressive dogs come occasionally on the property, and he would lunge toward one of those dogs, and if the dog didn't move immediately, he would literally pick it up and throw it 50 feet. And if the dog didn't get out immediately, you could see he was coming to actually kill it. And it was like he said, okay, you know, back off. I'm giving you one chance to get your act together, and then you're dead. So, and he was alone in these instances with dogs coming in. So it wasn't just always safety in numbers with him. He was like, I'm a big guy, I know it, and you're really on an ego trip here if you think you could even touch me on any level. So we had a baby that was born, Artemis, and I was sitting out with them one night just to make sure everyone was okay, and this big bear came in and walked by the corral where I was with the mother and the baby, and I was literally like shaking in my boots. I didn't even know what to do. I didn't know whether to run or stand there or start screaming, and but I took cues from the mother, Panther, of Artemis, and she just herded Artemis to the other end of the corral and then just stood there and watched the bear go by. And so I just kind of wandered over there with her and thought, well, safety in numbers, I'm standing here. And her curiosity and confidence was actually contagious to me. So I was more brave with the bear because of what the horse was doing. It was very interesting.
Mm, indeed, indeed. Okay, so in the next section, you talk about the idea of culling. And it made me think that it wouldn't be a bad idea for perhaps some of humankind as well, but that you're actually talking about culling amongst animals and distinguishing between the way sort of lions operate and horses operate. So can you just sort of describe what you mean by culling? I mean, I know we kind of all understand it, but what are we talking about in this particular instance?
Well, the word culling is specifically used to basically kill something that's that needs to die a humane death so that everyone else can survive. It usually has a combination of both. So that traditional herding cultures in Mongolia, they don't really eat a whole lot of meat. What they do is they mostly drink the milk of the animals, and sometimes they make products from the blood of the animals. And then at the end of the fall, right before the really cold season hits, they actually go among the herds and find the oldest, weakest, or sickest animals that aren't likely to survive the winter, and they cull them at that time, and then they dry the meat. And then during the winter months, the humans survive on the meat of the animals that were culled. But it's always done with a mindset toward balance. And they also never will eat their young animals. Even sick baby animals, they will not eat, even if the animal dies. We consider that a delicacy. We have lamb and veal farms, you know. And yet their orientation is that these are herd members who are valued and they deserve a chance to live. And they have real affection for these animals. And they'll bring them into their tents and nurse them back to health. And if one of these animals dies, they'll use the hide of the animal, but they will not eat the meat because they're so intimately connected with these as the children of the herd. And so culling, that predatory act of killing an animal for sustenance of the tribe, happens with regard to balance and to ending suffering while also nourishing the tribe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I wonder whether at what point do they start eating? You know, you said they don't eat the young.
Yeah, I think it probably varies from tribe to tribe. In Mongolia, they just don't eat animals under a year of age.
Hmm.
So, yeah. You know, if they're going to kill an animal for a special ceremony, which they will do sometimes also, it's not always at the end of the season. If there's some kind of really special ceremony, they will pick a particular animal for that, but that animal will have lived a full life already. That's generally what they're looking for, is someone who's had a chance to breed, to mature, to breed, to make other herd members, and then at a full point in their life, they may be chosen to move on.
And you say the predatory side of human nature is especially useful, perhaps even essential, in culling those social institutions, behaviors, and beliefs that need to die a humane death so that everyone can survive the winter. What sort of social institutions are you particularly thinking of there when you say that?
Well, I think that a lot of times when we're building a business, we may have a lot of different ideas on different income streams, and we may see that some income streams are more successful than others. And so if we're having a situation where we're in coming into economically hard times, we're going to look at all of the income streams and the people that are associated with those income streams and see which ones we may need to cull, we may need to cut off in order for the rest of the company to thrive and move forward when there's less economic resources. And so that's a hard thing to do. You have to have in that moment the sense of what a lion can instinctually do, which is just to see which member of the herd is the weakest and take that one out. And so at that moment, that is a tough decision you have to make, and you can engage your inner predator to help you do that.
Right. Okay. It was just interesting to me that you said institutions. I was wondering whether you were actually thinking in particular organizations or anything like that.
Well, I think there are different kinds of business practices, and there are some institutions that are organized around highly predatory business practices that are about thriving at everyone else's expense. And it's like, well, you know, if this institution or this business can change their ways and function more in balance with the rest of the economy and the rest of society in a way that's mutually beneficial for everyone, maybe that institution gets to survive. But if it continues to be predatory, then I think we have to take them out.
And that's kind of that's kind of the message of the whole book there, really, isn't it? It's about, okay, you know, out with the old, in with the new, because the old ain't working. So yeah, that was all.
Just give the old a chance to change before we take them out. I definitely believe in that.
You don't think they've had their opportunity?
Well, some of these old institutions, they don't have the skills. The skills in this book are designed to help people step out of the old ways and do something new. It's really, in some sense, not fair to blame everybody who's involved in an entire system that grew up over the last 5,000 years when they don't have other skills to just say, you're a loser, you're gone. Instead say, wow, can you see the things that you're doing that are not effective? Here are some new skills. Here are some new ways of doing business. If you can adapt those, great, we'll support you. If you insist on staying with the old ways, you know, we're going to work together as a herd to not allow you to be successful, and at the very least, you're eventually going to die off, and a next generation is going to come along with a different viewpoint.
Right, right.
So I'm not advocating like physical violence here.
Well, you were just demonstrating your sparing use of predatory power.
Yes, sparing use of predatory power.
Okay, so then you go on to talk about you give an illustration. Of predatory, a set of illustrations of predatory versus non-predatory. And I think that these are kind of fairly obvious to, you know, they make sense to people, I guess, when they read them. But what are the ones that you would like to sort of point out there as being kind of obvious ones to watch out for and what we can learn from them?
Yeah, so if you wonder if a particular business or business colleague even is acting in a predatory manner, just look at whether their main goal is to nourish themselves at everyone else's expense. I mean, that is just what predators, they have to do that. It's instinctual. They perform a reasonable service in balance with nature. But when that's their only goal is nourishing themselves at everyone else's expense, then you have to realize you've probably got a rabid carnivore on your hands. The thing that non-predatory power does is it supports individual and group needs simultaneously. So it's not that non-predatory power is self-sacrificing. It's not. Quite often we think of predator and prey. The predator eats the prey must be self-sacrificing. That's not true. From a power perspective, the non-predatory animals actually protect the most vulnerable members to allow them to strengthen and grow. They're not about self-sacrifice, except in extreme situations. For the most part, they're interested in supporting individual and group needs simultaneously.
Right. Okay. And what about some of the others?
Another one that's really interesting is most people don't really know this, I've found out. Maybe they kind of know it, but they've never made it conscious or paid attention to it before. But carnivorous species tend to be highly territorial, and they will sometimes fight to the death over their territory with other members of their own species. And non-predatory animals are nomadic. They move through seasonal migrations with their family members. So with carnivorous animals, the predatory power mentality is about territory over relationship. You know, my territory is more important than my relationship with others. With non-predatory power, relationship is more important than territory. Territory means almost nothing to those animals. Human beings are a combination of both. So I just think that we have to realize that relationship needs to be one of our more important goals. It's not all about territory and profit. Relationship is going to sustain us in the long run.
Sorry, say that last bit again. It's
relationship needs to be as important or more than profit and territory.
Right. Okay.
Because unless we form strong relationships, we don't have the power of the herd to help protect us from other predators.
But do we face predators? It sounds like a silly question after all of what we've discussed, but I mean, I'm not talking about humans versus, I'm talking between humans.
Absolutely. Most people act in a predatory manner when they've climbed the ladder of success in business or a lot of education are very predatory. What they're looking for is to boost their own position at the expense of somebody else. That's a classic predatory move.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, you're right. Yeah. Okay. This is quite a short guiding principle. So is there anything you'd like to sort of say in summary in terms of just as a general guidelines as to when you can use predatory power? I mean, obviously, we just mentioned it there. But, you know, is there kind of an easy way distilling that down?
Well, I think that the guiding principle itself, where it says employ non-predatory power liberally and predatory power sparingly, what you'll see is if you look down the column of non-predatory power, you're going to want to emphasize those elements most of the time. And as I mentioned earlier, about the only real productive use for predatory power is culling something that needs to go. And otherwise, you can set boundaries with people through non-predatory power. You can be ambitious with non-predatory power. You can profit through non-predatory power. As long as you follow a lot of these elements in the non-predatory power column. Even just the understanding that we talked about much earlier in the book, where in herds, the leader and the dominant animal are often two different animals. And then to realize that master herders in those herding cultures can take on the role of the leader when necessary, the role of the dominant when necessary. They also spend a lot of time in nurturing and companionship type activities, but they can also act occasionally as the predator when necessary. But in herding cultures, the humans don't engage in predatory acts very often. It's just under special occasions. For the most part, they're engaging in a form of non-predatory power that is very brave, courageous, and highly functional.
Yeah. Okay, I think that sums it up. So thank you for that. And we look forward to speaking with you on the next guiding principle.
Okay.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
Thanks.